Hello, class. It's your host, Dacia. Today, we're going to learn all about a composer named Elliot Carter. But before we learn about Elliot Carter, it's important to say a little something about Charles Ives. Not the Currier and Ives Ives. This is a different guy. This Charles Ives was a modernist composer. Anyway, Ives was kind of a big deal, but his work was totally ignored for most of his lifetime, and so he sold insurance to make a living. So it turns out that Charles Ives sold insurance to Elliot Carter's family. And Elliot really admired Charles's work, and so he wrote to him, and Charles encouraged Elliot to go forth and make music. And so he does. And then Elliot winds up at Harvard studying music, and also while he's there, P.S., adorably, he becomes a member of the Glee Club, and one of his professors while he's there is Gustav freaking Holst. You know, like the guy who wrote The Planets, which is the piece that inspired a little something called the score to Star Wars. Anyway, I'm on a tangent. So Elliot Carter, right? So he goes on to win a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Grammys, and he composes every single morning until his death at 103 years of age. Like, wow. Anyway, now that you know a little bit of something about Elliot Carter's life, let's learn about his music from Austin Woolaman and Christopher Otto of the Jack Quartet. Oh, and don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review our podcast wherever you listen. Okay, thanks. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical
music voice. I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Dacia Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Dacia Clay, and here with me today are Austin Woolaman and Christopher Otto of the Jack Quartet. You guys, I'm really excited for you to teach me about Elliot Carter today. I've read up a little bit about his life story, and he sounds super interesting. But I know that his music is perceived by a lot of people as being, like, air quotes, difficult when it comes to contemporary classical music for a lot of people. So can you tell me who he was first and what he's known for?
Well, Carter is, yes, he's one of the like leading figures of kind of high modernism in American music in the 20th century. And his music is notoriously dense in terms of both the pitch language and the rhythmic language. He explored time flows in music in really novel ways that people hadn't thought of yet at the time, or he explored it in really deep and kind of far-reaching ways that affected form and expression in his music in kind of unexpected ways. Mm. So his music does have both a density and sometimes a formal unfamiliarity at first listen that can be kind of imposing, I think, mm-hmm. at first. I'll speak a little personally because I feel like since we're entering through the through the lens of him being a little imposing, for me, he was actually mm-hmm. my inroad to contemporary music. And maybe that says
really?
Something about me as a person, but when I was 16 and, you know, played the violin and had just gotten into jazz and was listening to finding out about what all the different kinds of American 20th century music were, because I was like a pretty lame kid and I didn't know much. So I was like finding out at 16 about so much stuff. And you remember these email listservs that used to happen?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So I was on one that was just about like recordings of 20th century music, because I was like, oh, 20th century music, I want to learn about this. And one email, some person mentioned the music of Varese and this CD with Boulez conducting it. And so I went to my public library and I found it. They had it. I listened to it. I thought Varese was amazing. But the last piece on that CD was the Carter Symphony of Three Orchestras. And I think it may have been one of the first things by a living composer that I like listened to with the understanding that's what I was doing and really kind of doing that in a dedicated way. And I had no idea what was going on. It was completely confusing to me at first. I was like, wow, what an amazing amount of sound. I was overwhelmed by it, but I was excited by it. I found all the differences of tone, the different expressions I was hearing to be interesting. And I think also I was knowing that there were serious musicians and people who had thought about music a lot doing it. And I was like, oh, why don't I get it? I wish I did. So I listened to that piece like a bunch of times until I started to hear things in it, just kind of intuitively. I didn't have anything to read but the liner notes and a couple random things on the 1990s internet, which was not much. Yeah. And yeah, I sort of started to find the just extreme swings of expression really appealing and started to become fascinated by the different speeds that I could hear happening at the same time, that there would be one group doing something at one tempo and another at another, and one solo kind of soaring over it in the trumpet. At one point, I remember being like totally taken by this trumpet solo. And yeah, so it sort of started my fascination with music being a discovery and not an immediate understanding. But maybe there can be an impression at first, and then later I could come to a greater understanding. So that was my inroad to starting to become fascinated with 20th century music. But it wasn't through immediately having a like emotional knowledge of what was happening, but having a fascination with kind of the palette and the expression that was going on, if that makes sense.
Are there literally three symphonies playing this music? Or
essentially, yeah, that's basically what's going on in the piece.
I don't know if they're full or 80 they're not pieces, they're like quasi full, but I mean each orchestra has like most of the instruments, right?
Yeah, exactly. They are three large ensembles with most of the components of a symphony orchestra in them.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're like playing at the same time.
Yes, indeed they are. Yeah, coming in and out, like sometimes one is featured and then another starts to enter, or sometimes one enters suddenly. There's really interesting contrasts that get brought out because of that. I would love to see it live. I've only ever heard it on recording.
So I want to put Elliot Carter into a historical context. When did he live, and like who are his contemporaries? What schools of thought did he come out of?
Well, yeah. So I think he was born in 1908. And when he was younger, stylistically, he was a lot more similar to other American composers of the 30s. I mean, I've heard a few of his early pieces, like there's American Holiday Overture. And they're pieces that, you know, you could think of as more accessible, tonally related.
Sound like,
you know,
Copland. Rhythmic.
Yeah, very much in that vein, Copland. Huh. And so it was only later that he started to really go in this direction of more and more complexity and finding his own style and his own techniques.
Yeah, and some of those were influenced by like Schoenberg and some of those big kind of modern European voices.
Yeah,
sure. I think you could also like potentially see the entrance of some of those ideas into the U.S. through Ruth Crawford Seeger as a, you know, another East Coaster as important to his development, since she would have been working on that stuff before he was working in that style.
Especially in terms of the pitch language and the atonal, like starting to deal with sets of pitches and different intervals. And I think he really started examining each interval and what are the characteristics of that interval and how can I put different intervals together. And
when you say interval, can you explain what you mean?
Yeah, just the distance between two notes. So we could talk, you know, about the major seventh or the perfect fourth. And then taking those and like he was trying to like kind of construct his own language out of them. And he came up with his own system of kind of categories of ways to put together intervals to form larger chords instead of the major and minor triads that we're used to. And so as I started to listen to more Carter, I started hearing more as like, okay, this instrument might be playing a lot of this interval or that instrument is playing that interval. And the way that those pitches relate is one of the areas of fascination for me.
Yeah, he brings together a bunch of different ideas, but I don't think he can be put in exactly anyone's school. I mean, he's a contemporary of like Babbitt, for instance, and the American Serialists on some level.
Mm-hmm. We should define serialism.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Serialism is just a language developed by Schoenberg, which is why I brought him up, to have structure in atonal music, since it was a new idea in terms of totally equally weighted 12 pitches of the scale, like familiar from the keyboard, and whatever order you put those in, that's your row, the serial row, and then you can kind of play with segments or reordering or transposing or making harmonies out of the way the pitches are ordered in that. That's my attempt at saying that quickly.
That's great.
But he's not writing in that style. He's influenced by it, but that's not his.
I see.
That's not his bag. He's also not doing the same thing Stravinsky does. But I think he's also influenced by Stravinsky's work, and he's also influenced by Bartok. If you listen to the first string quartet, you can hear Bartok's language resonating in that piece, I think. So yeah, I think a lot of the different voices of the time started pushing him in a direction, and then he really kind of took his own route, influenced by his interest in what Chris was talking about with the intervals and having really specific expressive meanings in each piece, and then also the way he started to play with time and the way relationships between different speeds bring different expressions to the music.
Yeah, you know, I am preparing for this interview. I listened to a couple of the Jack Quartet's performances of some Elliot Carter works, and the Stravinsky. I think it was the third string quartet I was listening to. I could really hear the Stravinsky.
Oh, cool.
Influence.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, that. Yeah, like the sort of more dissonant parts of the Rite of Spring, like when that third, the Elliot Carter, the third string quartet starts up, it's just like It's just like the music is going in every direction at once.
Yes, it is. It's a pretty wild moment. I love opening a piece like that. It's just like kick down the door and then we can go from there.
That's a really good description. Yeah. It's interesting. It's kind of fun to listen to that. But whenever I, and it may be because I'm not super familiar with the tools that a composer uses to, you know, create a work of art. But when I hear music, particularly like this, particularly like serialism, things like that, when I hear those things described, I always think, you know, these sound like fun geometric experiments to do with notes. But I wonder sometimes where the heart is in it. And then I wonder if there has to be a heart, or if there is a heart, and maybe I'm just not realizing it. So what do you think about that question?
Well, I have like two answers to that question. I think there's two sides to it. One is you've totally correctly identified something really interesting about the music, which is that the way it's structured is totally amazing. And you could dig in forever into the structure of Elliot Carter's music. Like the third quartet is so rich with technical detail on every level, the pitch, the time, the way those interact, the way different levels of pitch interact, the way different levels of time interact. And then on top of that, the way he structures the form of the whole piece on top of that. And that's all really cool and interesting for somebody who's technically minded and wants to get into that.
Yeah.
But I would also argue that that technicality can become really vivid with a few repeated listens. So like in the case of the third quartet, for me, I like to think of the metaphor of a prism when it comes to that piece.
Yeah.
Oddly, the harmony is really static in that piece. He sticks certain notes in certain places in the quartet and they keep coming back. And sometimes he reveals this chord that just exists for the whole piece. So to me, it's almost like he has this prism, that's the prism. And then he's just shining light through it in different ways. So like at the start, there's like it's really bright. It's totally overwhelming. There's like a rainbow of stuff in front of your eyes. It's like unmanageable to try to parse out what's happening. You're blinded. But then gradually it starts to shift and you can start to see different aspects of it. And so that to me brings me to the other side of my answer, which is like, does it have a heart? Definitely has a heart, in my opinion. In fact, Carter is super romantic music, in my opinion. It's just overwhelming. So sometimes it's not obvious at first. I think the first listen can be imposing because of the level and amount of expression can sometimes just be crazy. Yeah. So, like, as it starts to thin out, I think he shows all these different sides and different aspects to character and expression that can exist within this structure that he has. So I think Third Quartet is great to talk about because with that piece, there's so many different little sections, each one of which is really carefully structured using the pitch and the speed to create moods that he even spells out. So, like, at one point it'll be, like, Allegro Giocoso, so it's, like, kind of fast and bouncy and fun. Or another part is an Andante Espressivo, and it's very drawn out and lush, sort of harmonic movement in that part. And other parts have there's an Appassionato section that has all these leaping intervals that are really, I mean, to me, really expressive to play, reaching all over the instrument and trying to like have these very romantic and yearning kind of lines to it. So it's full of that for me.
Yeah, and like expanding on that, the heart, I think it's, even though it's, we're talking about the technical side of it, it's very human music. And I think he was very interested in like different personalities and how different personalities can have different types of conversations with each other and the interaction of sort of mirroring human relations in music. And it's, you know, it takes a little bit of listening to get that, but there's oftentimes each player will have a distinct character in the second quartet, and also the third quartet is more divided into two duos, but the personality of the parts are very much defined by character, and like one player might be more rigid, one might be more mocking, one might be more expressive or lugubrious, or all of these characters. And then the way he kind of combines them and layers them on top of each other or in response to each other gives it this like very human conversation characteristic.
Yeah, and placing him into music history and cultural history, I've heard people who worked with him at the time he was writing a lot of his kind of iconic pieces, and in some of his own writing, talking about its relationship to a kind of democratic mindset. And I think it's related to a kind of post-war and late 20th century American feeling for that, a feeling for a multiplicity of voices that can come together to mean something, even if they're often in conflict. And exploring that kind of public discourse and a broad range of feeling and viewpoint.
Yeah, there's this phrase that a friend of mine has used before. Freaked out cat in a box. And that's what I often think about the contemporary mindset, you know, like what it's like to live in a city and be surrounded by all of these different people and all of these different things going on and all of this technology and all of it. And I think music, like the little bit of Elliot Carter's that I've heard, like is such an accurate description of that feeling. That's kind of interesting.
Although I think it has the kind of range even within that too, from the very dense urban kind of congested feelings to also like in the first quartet, he lived for a year in the New Mexico desert. And I think he was fairly isolated in a way and kind of got away from, because he had been in New York City and just living out there and like really coming to terms with that landscape there kind of influenced that piece. It may be hard to hear that at times, but there's an element to these super long phrases and really enormous gestures and palettes that you can kind of take a bird's eye view to it as well, which is another thing that I think in listening to his music, there's like so many different ways you can listen to it and distances. Like you can sort of put yourself in the thick of it and be like in the midst of that city like atmosphere with all these different people talking and all these sounds happening. And you can also kind of step back and like kind of get the overall picture of it, or focusing on one aspect of it. You know, there's all of these different ways into it.
What, if you were going to recommend a piece of Elliot Carter's music for somebody who's interested to start with, what piece might you recommend and why?
Well, I don't know. For me, I think the first piece of Carter's that I really got into was his second quartet, actually. It starts out in a pretty clear way, especially if you know, like, each instrument has a different character and each one is presented kind of in isolation at first, and you know, each movement kind of has a distinct focus on one instrument or the other, and so you can really, for me, like be taken on this journey of getting to know different people. It's almost not like a novel with these different characters introduced and responding to each other and then finally kind of coming together in this wonderful, brilliant climax.
Yeah, I think that's a really good answer, because it also, it depends on your background. But so if you wanted to listen to it as a character study, you could. And also, the cool thing about it is if you're more of a classical music listener, it also has a traditional four movement structure. And the characters fit with somewhat within a four movement framework that we're used to. Mm-hmm. Those characters relate to that. So you can listen to it and be like, oh, I'm in the scherzo part. Cool. Like, uh-huh. I get that, okay. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also am wondering, but this seems like, at least what I saw, it seems like very physical music to play. What is it like to perform this kind of music, both in like, what does it actually feel like to perform this music, like physically? What's that like? But also, what's it like to perform music that doesn't have those sort of touchstones that you're used to in music, like where it's got these the certain set of movements and these certain things to come back to?
Well, I think Carter is an interesting case, and it's one of the things that's kept it as one of my central interests in 20th century music since discovering it as a teenager, is that it's a really beautifully rich relationship between what's traditional about the way we've studied our instruments and gained whatever level of virtuosity we have on them, and pushing mm-hmm. that in new directions. His music is incredibly rewarding to try to tackle from just an instrumental standpoint. It's extremely challenging, but written thoughtfully for the instruments and pushing it in directions that feel, the word is just rewarding to me as a player. So the feeling of playing it can sometimes in performance be like, wow, I'm really getting stretched right now by how fast this passage is, or like how uh-huh. Much I have to get around the instrument right now. But that's like a fun challenge to tackle in the music.
Yeah.
And then also just speaking formally too, like he is pushing expression in different directions. New things are happening. But also, as I've gotten to know the pieces really well, you can find how it's even related to traditional forms, even in his most radical works. There's still these relationships to past ideas, to past kind of structures overall of the piece that help him shape things. That richness of the connection is really what I like about it.
You were saying this prism earlier, and this kind of, or this kaleidoscopic feeling of richness of interactions. To be on stage and like be listening to the relation of my parts to all the other parts, and feeling the ensemble challenges are, it's not only instrumental challenges, but a lot of ensemble challenges in terms of feeling our individual pulses against other pulses that are happening and other beats. And so there's an incredible rhythmic sense, I think, that in my body, at least, like, we're kind of feeling this common pulse, but then on top of that, there's other layers of rhythms that are incredibly dynamic.
I can't wait to dig into this music more.
He lived to be 103, so he's got this incredible, and he was writing music all the way up until the end. So you think about, like, he was writing music in the 30s, he was writing every decade all the way to the 2010 or 11, I think. And there's, incredible transformation that happened over that time period, from going from this earlier Copland style, gradually introducing these kind of different rhythmic elements and pitch elements. And then I think the peak of complexity, in a way, is the third and fourth quartets. But then, toward the end, he starts to like really crystallize a lot of these ideas. In another way, like you're asking about what music to start with, some of his late music is in a way more accessible because it's a little bit less frenetic. It's got a lot of, the music he was writing when he was 90 years old and 100 years old is like somehow a summation of everything, but crystallized in the kind of most compact form.
Well, yeah, just since we think about the quartets a lot, just speaking of the fifth quartet, it's meant to be an elucidation of his fascination with quartet rehearsals. So you hear all of this really cool kind of conversation, individual voices popping out, people imitating that. but still with lots of different ideas happening. And underneath all of that, he's taken these really cool ideas he has about rhythm and has made a structure based totally on these long-range polyrhythms that you don't have to know anything about to hear those characters and the short-scale expression, but it still has that kind of technical richness that we talked about in some of the other works as you dig into it.
So I'm just taking a little break from the interview to do a PSA, a podcast service announcement. Okay, here it goes. Did you know that one out of every 1 zillion podcast listeners listens to podcasts without donating to them? Do you know why? Because they don't know how. Take the time to learn how to donate to your favorite podcast today. And by that, I mean this one. Step one, go to classicalclassroomshow.com. Step two, find the tip jar button at the top of the screen. Step 3, click on it and make a one-time or recurring gift of any amount you like. Step 4, do the hokey pokey and turn yourself around because that is what it's all about. And knowing is half the battle. And also, only you can prevent forest fires, and this is your brain on drugs. OPS, while you're admiring our website, I should tell you that our friends at New Y made it and that they can make a cool website for you too. They can help you promote it as well. Find out more about those crazy kids at classicalclassroomshow.com/NW. That's N as in new and W as in Y. And now back to my conversation with Austin Willeman and Christopher Otto of the Jack Quartet. So I have been learning a little bit about you guys. And from what I understand, you know, like a lot of ensembles that are focused on new music, I've come to know that they do a great amount to like make this music more accessible to audiences, to perform music that is, you know, new classical, but that people will find accessible, that's more melodic and things like that. But from what I understand, that's not your focus. Like you don't shy away from tackling the stuff in contemporary classical music that is more difficult. Why is that?
Well, I take just a little different view on the word accessibility in this case. Mm-hmm. I understand the ease of inroad as far as what you mean around focusing on more melodic or tonal sounding music. And we're also not shying away from playing some things like that as well. But we love tackling things that present new and novel challenges for us because it stretches us as musicians, and that process of stretching ourselves and learning to embody these new styles, new techniques, new sounds, all the different things that we end up exploring, we find that that's actually really engaging right off the bat. First time listeners to contemporary music, because they can see us doing things that are different, start to hear sort of like exciting new aesthetic challenges get played out. And then also a lot of music that we play has a really intense physicality to it, whether that's a virtuosic physicality or something that's a more meditative and kind of still sort of exploratory vibe. So we like to kind of push those extremes and see what we can find there.
Are you afraid of scaring people away from the music at all? And like how do audiences react?
Well, you know, we've found that it's about expectations in a way. Like if we're playing for an audience that expects us to be playing Beethoven or that string quartets are a certain way, then people are going to have to realize that that's not what we're doing. But right. We've found that people, even audiences that aren't experienced in new music, can often find something to relate to with the kind of energy and commitment that we try to bring to everything that we play. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't understand why we're playing these sounds, I think people can understand and appreciate that, wow, they've really dedicated themselves to this form of music, and maybe they didn't even know that that existed. And for certain audiences, we try to introduce things in that way to try to open their minds a bit to like unexpected sounds.
Yeah, I would just add a couple things to that. One is that this idea of commitment, I think, comes through in terms of our presence on stage for people. And then because of that, I feel like because I'm committed to the style, I actually don't mind if some people don't like it. I think it's okay to react to art and not have your response be positive. That happens to people all the time with movies.
Yeah.
At the art museum, people walk right past pieces that they don't love. It's a little harder in the concert hall. You feel like you're maybe stuck there and it can be uncomfortable to not enjoy something. But I feel like it's one of the great gifts of a contemporary art form is part of the exploration isn't about assuming that it's all going to be great. We get to have our own minds. People don't get to have their own minds about Beethoven. If you don't think Beethoven's great, people are going to just think you're wrong. I think that's actually totally valid to think Beethoven's not great. And I think it's valid to not think Elliot Carter's great or Philip Glass or whoever. I think it's up to people to like have their own minds and discover in art the things that they relate to and what they find valuable in the art itself. So I like that part of the journey. Hopefully it can be not just a turnoff and a fear that it's not going to be a mollifying art form. I think it's, you know, people complain about that a lot with classical music. It's marketed as relaxing or just, you know, to like soothe your mind. And I'm definitely not interested in that. I like an engaging art and an art that even if it's about being meditative, it's done in a way that has depth and richness to it.
Yeah, a couple of things there. I really like that idea because life is not all about being happy or being relaxed or experiencing pleasure. It's all of the other sides of those things. It's all about, it's a whole array of emotions. And I think we're really used to other art forms engendering those responses in us.
Even other forms of music. I mean, there's other forms of music that use more familiar palettes of harmonies, but that also express really uncomfortable feelings and emotions. I mean, even singer-songwriters, through their lyrics and their performances, express really uncomfortable human moments. And I don't think the music needs to be uncomfortable. Don't get me wrong. I don't think all music has to be challenging you constantly and super abrasive or something like that. But I do think being able to explore a wide nuance of feelings or forms or even just abstract kind of senses like visual art does, I think music can do all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And being open to a variety of kind of interactions with the art form is something I would hope for.
Why do you think it is that classical music is sort of pigeonholed as this kind of mollifying music, as you said, like that, you know, it's meant to relax. And, you know, actually, you know, working at a radio station, the data bears out that people say that that's what they come to classical music for, like big, you know, large audiences. But when I talk to musicians, when I talk to performers and composers, they're not interested in doing that, you know, but that seems to be what people come to the music for. So what is that disconnect? Where does that come from? Why do people need to be soothed and relaxed by this music?
Well, I think there's a lot of different functions of music that are valid, and there's definitely nothing wrong with people wanting to listen to music to relax, and whatever music is to people, I think that's fine. It's just, it's not only that, you know? So there's kind of a more entertaining side of music or just like a more passive side and a more active side to it. And if people are coming to a concert with the expectation of being, wanting to be actively involved in it, then I think they're much more likely to get something out of any performance, not just contemporary, but older music as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think maybe because of habit and people tend to listen to the same things that they're used to, and then, you know, maybe they want more of that in some situations. But honestly, I haven't really, we've gotten so deep in the contemporary music world that it's not that we've lost touch with, you know, everyday people that aren't used to this, but we tend to like see a lot more people that are actively engaging in music than you might think.
Yeah, I think there are a lot. There is a hunger out there for that kind of concert experience. And I think the concert experience is where I would take an answer to this. And this, I don't know if this will be uncomfortably political to talk about, but entering my answer, I would just bring up that the recorded sound, I think, has a lot to do with this soothing quality. Mm. People do get really used to listening to the same record over and over, the exact same sounds coming into their head, especially as if they're listening while they read or late at night. Mm-hmm. I know I did that when I was younger a lot, listened to classical music as I went to sleep. So you associate it with those moments. And thinking about the associations of the music, I would also just say that the concert experience has been associated with wealth and privilege for many generations. Mm-hmm. And I think that at least the generation of musicians I know, the people that I'm friends with, and I'm sure lots of other generations too, have been interested in breaking that up. And I see things happening within the classical music community, whether that's among the traditional players or people commissioning music, to try to start to find ways to break that up, to make it a more socially diverse and, because of that, aesthetically diverse art form that reflects a concert experience that isn't uniform. And so I think some of those accessibility things can come through the styles itself that people choose.
Yeah,
I think there's just people are interested in new avenues, and to break up that kind of political milquetoast that is what classical music has been, and to hopefully, because of that, shake up the institutions that define what a concert experience is for people.
There's like so much to dig into here. Like I'm listening to what you're saying and thinking, yes, 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 all of that. I'm sold. I'm going to go listen to some more Elliot Carter.
Yeah.
This has been fascinating. Austin Willeman and Christopher Otto of the Jack Quartet, thank you so much for taking the time to teach me about Elliot Carter today.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, it's been great.
All right, everyone, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more episodes of the show, go to classicalclassroomshow.com, listen to everything, click all the social media links, send us an email there, or at classicalclassroomshow@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe to rate and review us wherever you listen. And now, listeners, a very special segment of the podcast that we like to call our Heroes section. Yes, these are listeners who have gone online and have given a financial gift to the program. You too can be thanked in song in an episode of the podcast, though it occurs to me as I say that, that perhaps that would be a deterrent for some of you. And if that's the case, I just want you to know, my silence can be bought. Anyhow. Did you ever know that you're a hero? That's right. I'm talking to you, Aaron Dent, Jeff Fine, Chad Rustin, Catherine Elder, and our monthly donors, my dear mom and dad. You're the best.
You are the wind beneath our podcast wings.
Thanks today to the home of Classical Classroom, King FM, and Oasis on your FM dial if you're in Seattle. Thanks to the birthplace of Classical Classroom, Houston Public Media. Thanks to Austin and Christopher of the Jack Quartet for being on the show today. To find out about their upcoming performances of Elliot Carter's music, check out jackquartet.com. Thanks to the official coffee provider of Classical Classroom, Kathy's Caffeine Kiosk, where our special ingredient may or may not be legal. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.